moving, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We got the love of the Thought Brothers and our sisters. The people together can over the...
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammack and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about shows and festivals coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to archive shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm and also via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music from 5:30 to 7, right here on KBOO. We hope you'll join us.
Rev up your support for KBOO Community Radio. Have an old car taking up space? Donate it to KBOO. Your unused vehicle can become music to our ears, powering independent radio that amplifies diverse voices and community perspectives. It's easy and hassle-free. Either visit kboo.fm/cars or call 1-877-KBOO-123. You'll get a tax deduction and the satisfaction of supporting local independent media. Donate your car to KBOO Community Radio today and drive change in your community.
Hi, this is Walt Perezada with the group Chicago, and you're listening to KBOO FM.
There was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Bill Resnick speaks with Eleanor Finley on happiness and development in different confederated communities. Fran Michel's Well-Read Red segment is based on a piece by Rob Wallace, posted by Monthly Review. And finally, Kevin Foster joins us to talk with Natalie Lerner about asylum seeking in Portland. First up, Bill Resnick talks with anthropologist Eleanor Finley on radical and representative democracies, the differences between them, and the impacts on the people living in each of these governing systems. Here's Bill Resnick in conversation with Eleanor Finley for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hello, Eleanor Finley. Welcome to KBOO again.
Thanks, Bill. It's great to be here.
Eleanor Finley is an anthropologist at the University of Massachusetts, finishing her doctorate with a thesis on radical democracy. After an exhaustive search of urban literature and anthropology studies, examining not just the Margaret Mead's best-known people of anthropology, but she also discovered obscure studies by grad students and other observers of indigenous and other small remote people around the world. Of course, the Iroquois Confederation is the best known of the indigenous democracies, but radical democracies have sprung up around the planet over the millenniums. So, Eleanor, to begin, remind us of the differences between radical and representative democracies, and then we can compare the differing impacts on the folks who live in each of these governing systems and evaluate which governing system is more conducive to human happiness, to intellectual and emotional development, and to political action that people really want. First, though, remind us of the differences between those two systems.
Sure.
Both who identify themselves as democracies.
So, Bill, you're right that there are many differences between what we call representative democracy or liberal democracy and radical democracy or direct democracy. Perhaps the most crucial difference is between representation and delegation. So in representative democracy, the narrative is that society is so big and complicated that instead of voting on issues directly, we vote for a representative who we trust to share our interests and desires and quote unquote represent our views for us. And of course, what we experience today in reality is that these representatives often have very little to do with our actual desires, and they don't really hold true to their constituents beyond what they see as important for the next election. So in direct democracy, people come together to make decisions in a face-to-face way. And in the ideology or narrative of representative democracy, that is simply impossible because society is too complicated. But what we see in direct democracies is that politics becomes much more grassroots, much more participatory, and much more decentralized. So people come together to make decisions face to face. Every individual gets one vote, and the community decides on all of the issues that really have an impact on their lives, which touches on another very important distinction between representative democracy and direct democracy, which is that in direct democracies, people have control over the economy. And again, the major institutions and processes that touch on everyday life. Whereas today in our current system, we not only live in a quote unquote representative democracy, we live under capitalism. So in fact, most of the major decisions that impact our everyday life aren't being made by representatives at all. They're being made by corporations. So that's another really critical difference between a direct democracy and a representative, quote unquote, democracy, is that the important decisions that shape our everyday lives, meaning how do we get our food? How do we grow our food? How do we manage transportation? Where do we get our energy from? How do we produce that energy? How do we disseminate goods? Those decisions are taking place among communities themselves, rather than being given to professionals. So as I mentioned, the narrative of our current system says that society is too complicated to be governed by direct democracy. But what we find in direct democracies is that they scale up via a relationship called delegation, meaning that communities do collaborate, they do cooperate amongst one another. They have confederations and councils that come together, but instead of using representatives who are empowered to vote as they see fit as individuals, the councils are composed of delegates who are obligated to bring the decision to the assembly. So in this way, power moves from the bottom up, from the assembly, to the Confederation instead of from the top down, from the central body outwards. So assemblies are making the decisions themselves and sending their delegates to communicate their decisions.
So
that's a really critical difference. And this relationship of delegation can be scaled up across multiple levels, which is what they have done in Rojava and other places like Chiapas, Mexico.
Yes, but what happens if there are real conflicts of interests and people at the in the assemblies, the initial assemblies, find it really onerous and impossible to meet that, whatever the goal is? Does that ever happen? Do they have to sort of eat crow and try and make do?
Sure. I think there are many ways to look at this question, and there is no one pattern of what real democracy looks like. I think that's something found through my studies, is that there are as many different ways of being directly democratic as there are direct democracies. Everybody does it a little bit differently. So there are many different ways to handle this question of what happens when there's an issue or a topic that just continues to really be contentious. So one way that groups can handle this is by adjusting their voting procedures. So if a direct democracy usually tries to seek consensus among the whole assembly, meaning that everyone agrees, they might adjust so that the vote only requires 2/3 of a majority to pass, or they might adjust from 2/3 to 50%. That's one way of achieving an agreement where there is an intractable problem. Another way that folks might deal with an intractable problem is by consulting with a confederation. If a community is really having a problem, you can bring in an arbitrator who can help work with people. However, I would add that conflict is an inherent part of this process. And in direct democracies, we are talking about a process that is generative. So rather than having two sides competing with one another, direct democracy is designed to take into account everyone's views from the beginning. So the objective of direct democracy isn't to beat your opponent and persuade everyone to adopt your view. The purpose of direct democracy is to come up with a solution that's new and different and takes into account everyone's position from the beginning. That isn't to say that there won't be really hot, contentious issues, but rather that it's designed for everyone to win together. It's a collaborative process as opposed to a competitive one.
Right. You want to go into something like this political science issue, why, in fact, our founding fathers found representative democracy so desirable? Do you have any
sense? Sure. I'd be happy to make some comments about that, although, of course, we don't have time to go into the whole story of how Constitution and government was formulated. But some insight I can provide is that the architects of the U.S. Constitution, James Madison and his followers and collaborators, they did not use the word democracy to describe their system. In fact, they considered themselves anti-democrats, and they really were scared of democracy. They hated the idea of democracy because they were scared that if a real democracy was implemented, that their economic privileges would be voted away. So the U.S. Constitution really was formulated by bankers and former aristocrats who wanted to protect their investments from the war and to protect their position in the new country. So again, we don't have time to go into all of the details, but that period of history is very interesting. And if folks are intrigued to learn a little bit more, David Graeber, the anthropologist and anarchist, has a wonderful chapter about it in his book called The Democracy Project.
Yeah, they're afraid of the people, you know, the unruly masses. If there is a real democracy, would eliminate their many privileges and tax them and maybe seize their property for public uses. I think that's very clear, actually, in the history. Bill Resnick here with Eleanor Finley on KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, on KABU's Old Mole Variety Hour. Eleanor Finley is an anthropologist studying societies, movements, and struggles for radical democracy. That compared to representative democracy, in which most U.S. North Americans hardly participate. We just compared the workings of radical and representative democracy, and representative democracy, the U.S. style, is hardly democratic. It's time now to discuss the differing impacts on the folks who live in each of these governing systems and evaluate which governing system is more conducive to human happiness, to intellectual and emotional development, and to winning public policy that the people actually want. So, Eleanor, compare the systems according to those criterias. What are the advantages on those criterias about municipalism, of radical democracy, and assembly policy?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the counterproductive and dreadful outcomes of representative democracy, especially, in fact, the U.S. version?
Sure. So this is a very broad topic, and we're speaking in very general terms. But something that I've noticed from talking to people who have a lot of experiences in democracies, not just directly democratic societies or indigenous communities who still use these very old ways of life, but also people who work in social movements and who strive to do participatory kinds of work, I've noticed a few things. And one is that in general, people tend to have more of a sense of satisfaction in their lives in general. And I think that comes with having a sense of power over your own life. When you know that you have a say in something, it makes you see the world a little bit differently. And just something that I've noticed, although I have not really studied in an in-depth and concrete way, is that people tend to have more satisfaction and confidence in their lives and who they are and in their communities. They tend to have a much deeper sense of connection to their community, to their neighbors, and just an overall sense of having a meaningful and connected sense of themselves. Something else that I've noticed is that people tend to see each other differently, and they really stop identifying one another by their ideology and instead look at one another as neighbors, and that people might feel very differently about an issue, or they might have very different ideologies or ideas about what is best or what kind of world they want to live in. But when it comes to the nitty-gritty everyday decisions about things like roads or schools, they tend to respect one another and see each other's position as valid and respectful. When you come together with people face-to-face, it's a lot harder to vilify them or demonize their positions. So that's something that I've noticed in the interviews that I've done with individuals, is that they really stop viewing each other as representing an ideology. They stop viewing each other as a right winger or a left winger and really start to see each other as neighbors. Something else that I've noticed is that people gain an increased sense of patience. And I think when you have very little control over your own life and the society that you live in, it can make you very impatient and angry. And something I've noticed from people who spend a lot of time in democratic environments is that they listen more and they have a learning mindset as opposed to a I want to almost want to say an aggressive mindset of wanting to feel heard. Urgency, that's the word I'm looking for. They lack a sense of urgency around really feeling desperately, you know, desperately needing to be heard. Rather, they have a more patient and receptive approach because they're comfortable in having their own perspectives respected when they choose to raise it.
You're right on in those observations. I would like to add, participating in a citizen assembly, over time, it creates a lot of knowledge of how your locality and other localities and how the world works. And that gives you a window on your position in that system and provides you with the materials to forge an identity that you're comfortable with. People have setbacks in life. Everybody has setbacks. Bad things happen. You feel bad. You may even get out of control of yourself for a while. All of us have, it seems to me, problems of that type, and you're searching for control. But I think the knowledge you have of the universality of that, it makes it much easier to deal with setbacks and a reorientation. Anyway, that's my contribution.
That there's an emotional resilience that comes when you know that your community is there should you need something, should you have a crisis. Those are powerful, really kinds of wealth that we lack in our current society. Bill, you brought up, you know, what are the detrimental impacts of living in our current system, which again, really isn't a democracy. The label democracy being applied to our current system is really just kind of a piece of propaganda because people have almost no say over what happens in our collective affairs. And one of the major consequences that I see on a daily basis is that people invest enormous amounts of energy in consuming things, in shopping and going out to eat and finding a trendy restaurant and their clothes. And which isn't to say that those things aren't also a valid part of life, but there's a pathological need that people have to find meaning. And we really are trying to fill a void in our lives with things. If you took away that materialism and that consumer culture, many, many people would be left with lives that feel really kind of meaningless. And what I've noticed for people who participate in civic assemblies is that they have a much greater sense of satisfaction in actively creating the worlds that they live in. It's also much easier to connect to people on a social level. If you're regularly attending citizens' assemblies, you can be a part of things and a part of projects that help your community. And people tend to have a lot less of a materialistic scarcity outlook on life and are more interested in how they can be a creative force in their own world. I think that's something that's really important. Another aspect of living in a direct democracy that I've noticed that's closely related to that sense of satisfaction is that people have a better sense of humor, I've noticed. I've spoken to many Kurdish people who have participated in popular assemblies through their movement, and people have a wonderful, open sense of humor and just a sense of joy in their lives that I notice is lacking here in the United States, especially in places where people have very little say over their lives.
Eleanor Finley, a radical anthropologist, she studies a relative democracy around the world, its many virtues. My sense is, Eleanor, that probably most of us believe that it's not going to come to the United States. It couldn't happen. That it's impossible. People are not going to make those sorts of changes. I think that there's a need for it, and the need will be recognized by a great majority of the people who will demand action when climate change becomes intolerable and threatening and dangerous with frequent climate catastrophes and disasters. People will say we have to change our way of living. And of course, the corporations and capitalists will have their program, and we'll have to defeat it. Their program is heavy on the technologies they're developing, like geoengineering and carbon capture and sequestration and putting balloons in space with mirrors. They don't want to change their ways. They just want to change the world's environment. I think that we can win that battle, and the battle will be for local solutions, energy democracy. It's by far the least expensive, not cheapest, the much least expensive and more realizable than any other way of saving the human experiment from the great rise in the concentrations of greenhouse gases. Anyway, I'm wondering if you would like to talk about that. And do you see that same possibility?
Sure, I do. I'm an optimist. Your framing reminds me of a quote that people find it easier to imagine the end of the world than they do to imagine the end of capitalism. You know, it's a funny paradox that we are living in, and not just funny, but also profoundly tragic, that people can imagine and accept terrible things happening. But when you bring up the possibility of a positive development, that's seen as somehow unthinkable or impossible. But like you, I think that there are many wonderful possibilities for change here in the United States, despite all of the problems that we have. And even to a certain extent, despite the seemingly intractable political divisions that we have. I think that we live in what is this wealthiest country in the world and that really the history of humanity. And despite that wealth inequality, we have so much available to us to build an alternative technology, a sustainable technology, and to run it in democratic ways. I also think that we have some really wonderful democratic sensibilities here in the United States. Again, despite the turn towards the right in recent decades, the United States really does have a culture in many places that is truly cosmopolitan and open, and people believe in egalitarianism and anti-racism and feminism, even if those ideals aren't realized. The fact that we have them is not inevitable. There are many other parts of the world where those values aren't as strong. And I really say that from experience and not out of a sense of chauvinism, but just that, you know, even in the United States, we have a lot more to work with than we realize to construct a democratic society. I would caution, though, against the argument that as climate change gets worse, people will inevitably see the need for a new system. I think that we've already seen people retreat from positive political possibilities as climate change has gotten worse. I think there are a lot of different responses that people can have to climate change. And at the very least, we shouldn't rely on things getting worse to inspire people to change their minds. I see that people change their minds when they see a better alternative. So I think we're best served by doing what we're doing right now, which is talking about democratic and participatory ways of life and how they truly are much easier to achieve than people realize. Maybe easier is the wrong word. How they truly are achievable and that they are fulfilling and that they really do provide solutions to issues like climate change, to the transportation crises or crises in education, you know, our society has a lot of problems. And I think participatory ways of life can offer so many solutions. But again, I think we have to rely on showing those solutions to people rather than hoping that things will get so bad that they'll change their minds. I think we see that actually in, you know, history has shown that that really rarely happens. Rather, people change their minds when they see that there's something better.
Yes, I agree with all of that. Still, I think we have to both point out that the climate change is upon us and serious and threatening for our lives. And then we have to create model cities, tangible things that are operating successfully, who in fact deal successfully with the problem and in fact create better lives for most of us. Anyway, Eleanor, it's a really interesting conversation. Eleanor Findlay, thanks for talking to us today.
No, thank you, Bill. Really, the pleasure is mine.
That was Bill Resnick talking with Eleanor Findlay for the Old Mall Variety Hour here on KBOO Community Radio. And Herbie Hancock, too. We heard a bit of Rocket from 1983. Up next, Fran Michelle shares her reading from Monthly Review, the piece titled Whether Bird Flu is on the March, Misses the Point by evolutionary epidemiologist Rob Wallace. Here's Fran Michelle for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
Good morning, this is Fran Michelle, sharing some lightly edited excerpts from a post by Rob Wallace titled, Whether Bird Flu is on the March Misses the Point. Wallace is an evolutionary epidemiologist at the Agroecology and Rural Economics Research Corps and Pandemic Research for the People. He is the author of Big Farms Make Big Flu, Dead Epidemiologists, and most recently, The Fault in Our SARS, and is co-author of the more technical monographs Neoliberal Ebola and Clear-Cutting Disease Control. Wallace has consulted for the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the CDC, and the People's CDC, and has been a guest on the Old Mole Variety Hour. His post originally appeared on his Patreon, to which you can subscribe for as little as $1 a month, and was republished at MR Online, where you can find the full text with all the details, diagrams, and documentation. In summary, he argues that the media flurry about the H5N1 strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza, or HPAI, is more about sensationalism, misdirection, and xenophobia than about information or action. That the bigger picture is that neoliberal capitalism, with its concentrated industrial agriculture, exploitative labor relations, and environmental destruction, will continue to generate and disseminate disease. And even the best responses and mitigations will be rearguard actions unable to prevent disease outbreaks. A robust public health system could provide important protections against these outbreaks, but the ongoing COVID pandemic has instead occasioned further undermining and dismantling of public health in the U.S. Wallace details that avian influenza has been circulating and thus mutating in dense agricultural settings for some 30 years, has increasingly been infecting mammals for the last 2 years, and we do not know how fully it will move into humans because research has been truncated and defunded and surveillance is spotty and inadequate. He points out that despite evidence that H5N1 has been circulating on U.S. dairy farms since last year, despite missing data that suggests even more herds are infected than is known, and despite anecdotal reports of widespread illness among dairy workers, few animals and fewer people have been tested. Wastewater monitoring does not distinguish between different strains of flu or between bovine and human sources, and the CDC recently declined to even consider a proposal to do this kind of screening. Moreover, with the government response of paying farmers to cull infected animals, farmers who are massively profitable agribusiness concerns and culls that entail no further action to prevent future spread, the government, in effect, encourages the continuation of the very practices that are causing the problem in the first place, and current arrangements allow agribusinesses to compel contract farmers to take the major risks, allowing concerns about disease to be directed against immigrant laborers rather than against the corporations driving the current food system. Reflexive reassurance about food safety is designed more to quell panic than to assure health. So, although Wallace provides some detailed discussion of what is known about the H5N1 virus and its circulation, that's not where he starts or what he stresses. "Whether bird flu is on the march misses the point," he writes. Quote, "You'd expect a report on the new round of highly pathogenic avian influenza spilling over into mammals and humans to begin with a Just the Facts update. But to start with such an encapsulation would serve only to miss the point of the latest epizootic episode, much in the way the near entirety of the press corps has in splattering H5N1 all over us, and just off its role in burying the still-circulating COVID-19. To understand this bird flu, we need to begin elsewhere. Indeed, on other topics entirely. Liberal governance mid-century cared about democracy and welfare economics only to the extent that they together helped diffuse rebellion against capitalism's intrinsic expropriation. They served as social bribes. Once the U.S. empire began to wilt on the far side of the cycle of American accumulation, the bureaucrats who followed folded away even this utilitarian generosity. Keeping the machine running unimpeded now involved, on the one hand, sharper forms of labor discipline, and, on the other, assistance largely in ridiculous lines of expensive credit as just another market into which capital expanded. Concern over possible pandemics comes in more regular waves than actual outbreaks. That should be considered a good thing. A deadly pandemic every couple years just seems horrific. Wallace learned over 25 years of tracking bird flu, however, the danger may also be in the alerts serving more to absolve the world system from acting on the alarms. Each surprise that the virus refuses to cooperate with hopium, acting in its own interests instead of ours, also serves to protect the system from the implications of its refusal to act. These surprises, pretending we don't know what we know, are themselves an ideological project. The logic of fantasy remains stuck to the logic of production. The business of governing a system in decline, after all, is about managing expectations. All is well. Get back to work. Until, suddenly, it isn't, as it always was. Emergency responses are critical, of course, but such logistics are an indirect, if perhaps in most cases unintended, means by which to avoid addressing the greater foundational context driving the emergence of diseases. That is, however critically unaware its practitioners, the omission serves as an ideological design feature partial to the present political and economic orders. Do not mistake our meaning. We all must continue to pronounce the obvious, otherwise our cynicism flatters us into inaction. From COVID to Palestine, fascism, a death cult, isn't a political party. It's a social formation wherein the political class of both parties stateside redirects the accumulating rage at a program organized around helping the rich cash out on the last of the public commons, redirects it upon the poorest and most vulnerable. If you want to stop a virus primed to kill a billion people, you'll have to replace the present system. No new vaccine or mask mandate or animal rights or conservation program the rich have already captured will be enough. We'll have to junk these relations of production in favor of creaturely eco-socialisms region by region. Otherwise, if the present genocide hasn't clued you in, The investor class, North and South, are prepared to sacrifice all whom they deem unuseful. They are even now enclosing the bedrock of our natural order, clean water, what fertile soils remain, temperature itself, to the last gulp of plague-free air.
Are we prepared to snap out of the fog of their necromaniac assurances? Are we ready to reject the rearward model that emergencies are to be addressed only after the fact? Are we set to save our own lives from those blithely fixed upon sacrificing them? End quote. This has been Fran Michel reading from Rob Wallace's essay, Whether Bird Flu is on the March Misses the Point, available at MR Online.
Fran Michel for the Old Mole Variety Hour and some new order to fill the gap here on KBOO Community Radio. To close things out this episode, Kevin Foster joins us speaking with Natalie Lerner about border policy and conditions for asylum seekers here in Portland. Here's Kevin Foster for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hello, KBOO listeners. I'm happy to have Natalie Lerner with me on the Old Mole Variety Hour today. Natalie is studying law and has been involved in mutual aid organizations for migrants for a number of years now, and she currently volunteers with the Asylum Seeker Solidarity Collective, which is a community organization that helps provide services and housing for asylum seekers in Portland. And I want to talk a bit about Biden's border policies, but I'd first like to start off more at the local level. So, Natalie, could you give us some background on the current situation with asylum seekers in Portland, especially for somebody who maybe doesn't understand or know all the challenges that they're facing?
For sure. So starting in 2022, and I think folks might have seen in the news, Greg Abbott started busing migrants to northern cities out of Texas. And a number of those folks had had Portland put on their paperwork. They were not bused to Portland, but they were bused to other cities, ended up making their way to Portland, but didn't know anybody here, didn't have anywhere to live. And from there, that has only happened to more and more people who are sort of arbitrarily given Portland at the border, or they're arbitrarily sent to another city and they hear family members here and they hear, you know, Portland seems like a great place to be, which I agree, Portland is a great place to be. And so they end up here, but without resources, usually without family, or if they have family, their family is not very stable. And most of them, if not all of them, are arriving like totally unsheltered and unhoused. So that's been happening in an escalating way over the past couple of years. And currently we're seeing anywhere between, you know, 3 and 10 new families with children contacting us every week who have either just arrived in Portland or just lost their housing in Portland, but arrived recently, who are asylum seekers. So they're unable to legally work still, trying to comply with this legal process they're being put through, but in a really hard spot because they can't be legally working while they're trying to stabilize their families here as well.
Yeah, I feel like after working with some groups on a news story, that was such an astounding fact to me that I didn't realize that asylum seekers are not legally allowed to work. And just, I can't even imagine the impact that that would have. And it's, you almost wonder in some ways, like, just, it's a whole new challenge, even if you do manage to get across the border. But in terms of Biden's border policies, he's set up this daily cap on the number of people that can cross the border. And then he's also advanced some things so that he can deport migrants who crossed illegally. And I think a question that comes up for me around that is why does somebody cross the border illegally seeking asylum?
For sure. I mean, I think there's a number of different things, right, to unpack. First, I think it's really important that everybody, when they're thinking about asylum, remember that asylum is a legal right. And the UN and UNHCR are really emphatic that irregular entry for the purpose of seeking asylum, which people are doing because they're fleeing danger, should not be penalized. And so the US is in total contravention of international standards for penalizing asylum seekers in this way. But, you know, people are coming here fleeing really horrible things. I mean, last week, my partner and I were hosting for just a week this lesbian couple from Venezuela who both had experienced just horrible, one of them like really gendered violence and the other super sort of gendered and anti-queer violence and had been almost killed by people in her life for being visibly queer. And so they had to flee. And it took them, you know, 6 months of hitchhiking to get to the US. And then it took them months and months to get this appointment through CBP1, which is this application that people who cross quote unquote the right way are supposed to use. But aside from like people are fleeing horrible things that are leading to them crossing the border, CBP1 is, from everything I've heard, really random and challenging. You know, people, border organizations have reported people wait at minimum like 2 months for an appointment, but people wait 7 or 8 months to try to get this appointment to cross the border. And that whole time, they're living in cities that are really dangerous for migrants in northern Mexico. They're at risk of being deported by Mexican officials who are being pressured by the Biden administration to deport people out of Mexico. They're, you know, attacked by cartels and gangs that prey on migrants in these areas. Often people are discriminated against in terms of access to healthcare. So God forbid you're like 5 months pregnant when you get there and you're waiting your months and months and months and you're only getting more pregnant. Like, people often have no choice but to cross the border, quote unquote, illegally, because otherwise they're putting themselves in grave harm. And I think when you're looking at the possibility of some legal bad thing happening to you and the reality that you could die if you don't cross the border right then, you know, it's a pretty clear choice. And that's not even to mention Mexican asylum seekers who are crossing from their own country where they are fleeing into the United States, which is, you know, it's not like they have some other third country they can wait in while they're trying to get out of Mexico.
Yeah, it's funny in a way that we say illegal crossings when considering the nature of asylum in international standards and just how it just doesn't even really make sense. But I think with this threshold on migrants coming in, do you think that could have the effect to, in essence, just increase the so-called illegal crossings? Because generally speaking, when we think of people who are crossing for asylum, they're doing it for a reason. They went on this journey through a number of countries and challenging circumstances to get here because they wanted a better life. And yeah, I think that's, I'm just wondering if maybe it will just see an uptick in that, and then that could also lead to more action on enforcing this deportation rule.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to say what the impact of the rule will be. I mean, I think realistically, the number of CBP1 appointments has not changed in a year. And so I don't really see why the numbers of people crossing between ports of entry would change. You know, like, the appointments have not been enough and people are continuing to flee. And so the appointments will keep not being enough. And it's been, you know, my understanding is that the cap is really close to the number of CBP1 appointments per day. It's like 100 more. And so it's hard to say. I mean, of course, I think that the way that the rule is justified is like it will have a deterrent effect. People will not want to cross illegally because the consequences are so punitive if you cross between ports of entry and you don't have one of these really narrow exceptions apply to you. But yeah, I guess it's hard. I've been meaning to speak more with the folks here who like all have family who are trying to get here about their impressions of the rule. And I haven't really heard people talking about it, which makes me wonder, you know, how much people understand that it's different than the previous like asylum ban that was already in place as of May of this year, or like right up until this rule is in place. But I think that that's something that, you know, something I'm really struck by is like, how much the government, I think, assumes asylum seekers have an understanding of like, ooh, these minute rule changes that actually have massive impacts. Like, I would imagine that when you're fleeing for your life and you're trying to get into a country with a totally different legal system and a totally different language, that like you're not going to understand all of the regulatory details. And so I think there's also a certain amount of expecting people to be understanding this really draconian and complicated legal process that they're going through without giving them any of the tools to understand it.
Yeah. And do you think that even though we had the asylum ban before that, has there been a dramatic shift in policy from the Democrats? Is this, if so, like, why do you think that is? Why do you think they're moving that way?
I mean, because it's an election year. to me, it's so clearly like Biden is getting slammed for not being tough enough on the border, and immigration is this big political wedge issue. And, you know, this like evil bill that was afoot in February of this year didn't pass because it wasn't right wing enough, even though it actually proposed to do a bunch of the stuff that this executive order is now doing. You know, I think it's this like race to the bottom, pandering to right wing voters. But to me, it makes no sense because none of those people are ever going to think that Biden is tough on immigration. And So I think he's alienating a lot of people on the left. I mean, through a lot of his policies, but immigration being one of them, and not really like gaining on the right, in my opinion. I'm not an electoral analyst, but that's my take on the situation.
Yeah. I feel like the thing that struck me, of course, was the policy, but also just sort of the shift in his rhetoric. I remember in the State of the Union address, he specifically used the word illegal to describe somebody who crossed, and that just, you know, these things that we, at least I felt like we weren't really seeing from Democrats as often anymore. And I think that I start to wonder if those can have a profound effect on not only on the left, but primarily in migrant communities. I think you said that it doesn't seem like there's too much focus on that for a number of reasons, but is there a specific emotional burden with being a migrant or an asylum seeker? I mean, looking at our national politics, it feels like there's so many people who don't want you here in that case, which for one reason or another. And I feel like that could have an emotional burden on people just hearing the president of this country using completely dehumanizing language. And, you know, on top of that, you're already going through so many things. And does that play a role in how asylum seekers are feeling here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it does. I feel like it's not something I can totally speak to, obviously, not having personal experience as an asylum seeker, but I think people feel like things are really stacked against them. I think part of it, or what I hear from people a lot and have been hearing a lot recently, is just how much people did not understand how hard it would be in the United States, because I think the U.S. does a good job of projecting a really specific image in the world of, you know, this wonderful place to live. But if you're undocumented, for all intents and purposes, migrant who doesn't have any money and doesn't have any family and can't speak the language, and then on top of that, to the extent you're following politics, you're a political football, I think that really takes a big toll on people, both, you know, materially and emotionally. And a lot of folks have really expressed a like, you know, if I'd known what it was going to be like here, I would not have made the decision to come, but now Here I am, and it's really hard to get back home also. So like, yeah. I just roll with it, which I think makes sense, but is hard just knowing how much people have gone through and sacrificed to get here, to see like how challenging their experience is once they do actually get here.
Do you feel like there's too much of a focus on the border specifically when, I mean, you're in the thick of it, that when we have these incredibly difficult conditions for migrants who make it here?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of Democrats in these blue states that Greg Abbott was playing chicken with to try to receive a bunch of people would say, well, like if the border were more secure, then we wouldn't be having this issue. So I think people blame border policy, but I also think, to me, so much of, at least in Portland, what this situation with asylum seekers is revealing is just how completely messed up our housing policy is. I mean, it's less about oh, that migrants specifically have such a hard time. And it's more to me like an indication of how poorly set up our sheltering system, and especially our family sheltering system, is for people who really need it. And that right now is asylum seekers, but it's also lots of other families and individuals here and in other cities. And so I think the border becomes like the point of blame, instead of like, maybe if we had good, just housing policy and allocation of resources, then it would sort of be a non-issue how many people are coming into our communities, because we'd be in a place to really readily receive them.
Yeah, so it's more like revealing the cracks, and then instead of trying to fill them, the people just start yelling at the cracks.
Right, or they're like blaming that people are crossing the border and not blaming that already we had 300 families on the family shelter waitlist here in Portland before any of this ever happened, and this is just making it more obvious.
So where would you like to see things go from here, both in Portland and the national level? And I'm not sure that this is necessarily or within the realm of realism for what is happening, but what needs to happen to make the situation for asylum seekers better?
I mean, I think most immediately this rule should be rescinded. I also think the circumvention of lawful pathways from last year should be rescinded. Mm-hmm. I think both of those rules are really...
Could you describe that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Circumvention of lawful pathways in some ways was like a light version of this current rule. So people, what mm-hmm. it said is if you don't cross with a CBP-1 appointment, or you didn't apply for and were denied from asylum in a transit country, or like can show that you couldn't access CBP-1 because of language or disability, you're presumptively ineligible for asylum. And you can show that you're eligible for asylum if you meet some special exceptional circumstances, which are like imminent bodily harm right before crossing the border, medical emergency right before crossing the border, which are the same exceptions that apply under the current rule. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways it was similar, but it didn't have this like cap emergency circumstances situation. And there's some other like evil new things in the new rule that make it worse, including circumvention of lawful pathways does not apply to Mexicans because it's about transiting through other countries, and the new rule does. But I'll just say, I think both of those rules should be rescinded. I think, you know, if the administration wants people to use CBP-1, they should dramatically increase the number of appointments that exist and expand access to the app, like make it easier to use for people. I mean, those are like, both feel like realistic, you know, I'm like, those are things they could do. It's totally in their hands to make those decisions. It doesn't require like massive political upheaval. I also think broadly, there's a real need to address the root causes of why people are migrating. I think certainly as the climate collapse only accelerates, more people are going to migrate. And the US is obviously a major contributor to that. So like addressing our funding of wars in other countries and climate collapse could go a long way. But here locally, I think that we, you know, in something that I got into when we were running this campaign on Multnomah County to pass funding for asylum seekers is that in 2009, the county passed a children's bill of rights that includes that children have a right to shelter. And I think that I'd like to see people like actualizing that and really setting a policy, certainly at the county level and ideally at the state level, that families, that there is enough shelter for all families who want shelter. You know, I think that's like kind of crazy to have to even say, right? I think we should assume that everybody unsheltered should be able to access shelter. And right now for families with children, that's not the case. So I think that that's like the policy change I'd like to see locally. And I, in the interim, would like to see sheltering that is much more responsive to some of the immigration issues that people have, or, you know, folks I think are really struggle in mainstream shelter because not very many caseworkers speak Spanish, and adult shelters are really set up for folks with behavioral health issues and substance issues, which is totally fair and reasonable, and is not like, this is a new sort of emerging population that has its own set of vulnerabilities and needs. And I think funding from the government to support sheltering agencies in meeting those specific needs would also be really helpful.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's a lot of work to do, but I'm happy you're out there with the asylum seekers trying to figure it all out. But yeah, thank you, Natalie. I really appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks so much for chatting with me.
That This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for the 1st of July, 2024. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Kevin Foster, Fran Michelle, and Bill Resnick, and to their guests, Eleanor Finley, Rob Wallace, and Natalie Lerner. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.
Who goes by the name of Killer Joe. Picture a so-called hippie or hip cat standing on a corner in a neatly pressed, double-breasted, form-fitting pinstripe suit, a pair of pointed-toed shoes with bold white stitches around the soles, a black shirt, long white tie, a black pencil mustache, and of course, a very wide-brimmed black felt hat. Killer Joe always has a pocket full of loot, but only the kind that jingles. You see, he likes to play the horses. He is most certainly a ladies' man. As a matter of fact, he is always willing to accept cash contributions from them for any cause, namely his own. The most important thing about Killer Joe that you have to know is that he's very much against manual labor. Killer Joe.
KBOO Portland.
Want to be in the know for all things Ghost of Hollywood? Check out our website at theghostofhollywood.com for all the newest episodes and updates.
And don't forget to listen every other Friday live.